What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. Thanks so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. Please rate and review the show on iTunes. And of course, you can support the show on Patreon. That's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. This week's Patreon only episode is an extended interview I did with the excellent journalist Ken Klippenstein. On this episode, I'm joined first by Nando Villa. He and I discuss the breaking news. It looks like Joanne Reed will be filling Chris Matthews' spot on MSNBC. The Wall Street Journal reports that Joanne Reed is in talks to fill the 7 p.m. slot once held by Chris Matthews and his longtime MSNBC show Hardball. Then I talk to State Senator Julia Salazar, who just won her re-election. And we talk about Jamal Bowman's victory over Congressman Elliot Engel. Then Ken Klippenstein joins us from The Nation to talk about his reporting and his latest piece on Elliot Engel's foreign policy. Welcome to The Katie Halper Show, everyone. I'm Katie Halper, and here with me is Nando Villa.
How's it going?
Good, you?
Good.
And we're gathered here today to talk about the news, to talk about politics, and we have two great guests. Not one, but two great guests. Ready? Joining us, state senator, as in someone with power.
Wow.
Julia Salazar.
She's not just like us. She's not just tweeting all day like us, you know.
No,
she's
no.
Passing laws and shit, like, yeah. You know, like writing the law.
Right.
What do they even do? How do they even do that?
I don't know. Cuneiform or something. But yeah, right. We tweet truth to power. She speaks and legislates truth to power.
Right.
And then we have on Ken Klippenstein. So my phone dropped. So I'm going to get out of screen for a second and grab my phone. Nando, can you handle this? It's going to take me 10 seconds. Okay, go.
Well, F Funk, you ask, is Nando short for Fernando? And the answer is yes. My real name is Fernando. My middle name is Duncan, weirdly.
My last name is? Wow, and I guess we got a dunk on you for that one.
Hey.
Fernando Duncan Villa?
Duncan. And then
Duncan.
My
right.
Full last name is Rodriguez hyphen Villa.
Villa.
It's just too long. It's too unwieldy. So I go by Nando Villa.
It's too unwieldy. Yeah, that's a good idea. Everyone grab their drinks if they want. If they want some drinks, what do you got? Do you have like a water bottle? Oh, he's so annoying. He's so LA.
I got my kombucha tea.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Do you have a shake? Do you want it? We can hold on if you need to like use the blender for something with wheatgrass.
Right. Yeah. A protein powder.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we're very excited. And the first order of news is that we have some breaking news, which I did not know about, which Nando informed me about. Do you want to break it or should I break it? This is a very collaborative show.
It's your show.
It's my show. All right. Yeah. Okay. So you guys, you may have noticed the absence of a dear MSNBC host who goes by the name of Chris Matthews.
Yeah.
We lost him. Funnily enough, it really wasn't because he compared Bernie Sanders to a Nazi invasion.
It was part of it.
It was part of it. What was it? He compared it to...
He's like, yeah, these Bernie supporters wear like the brown shirts.
Yeah, brown shirts, right. He compared it to the brown shirts. No, that was Chuck Todd. I believe what Chris... Didn't Chris Matthews compare it?
Oh, yeah, he goes... Yeah, he was like... Reminds me of World War II as a French general. It was like, you know, after the Nazis passed the Maginot Line, they were like, we can't do anything to defend it. We can't do anything to stop them.
Exactly.
That's Bernie. He's a Nazi passing the Maginot Line.
Right, right. Bernie was the Nazis invading France. That was what his winning one of the caucuses was.
Was the fall of France, yeah.
Yeah, the fall of France. Then he was afraid that Bernie was maybe like Fidel Castro and there were going to be executions in Central Park. Yeah.
I don't support the Reds. I'm anti-Fidel Castro.
I know, that was amazing. That was great, the Reds. Yeah, we should probably play some of his greatest hits, honestly.
I have an attitude towards Castro. I believe if Castro and the Reds had won the Cold War, there would have been executions in Central Park, and I might have been one of the ones getting executed. And certain other people would be there cheering, okay? So I have a problem with people who took the other side.
And he farted in an interview.
Oh, Fartgate.
Yeah. Well, so he's just like, he was losing. And I think the bosses were like, listen, man, we can tolerate you comparing Bernie Sanders to literal Hitler, but farting on national TV is a little too much for us. So
yeah, I agree. Yeah. But you know, what's sad is that I honestly think that it was because of not sad, but I don't think anyone cared about that part. I think it really was because of some Me Too stuff that he got into trouble for.
Let me start with my headline tonight. I'm retiring. This is the last hardball on MSNBC.
Is this a rumor that you're hearing behind the scenes?
No.
Compliments on a woman's appearance that some men, including me, might have once incorrectly thought were okay. We're never okay. Not then and certainly not today. And for making such comments in the past, I'm sorry.
It was just weirdly coincidental, I guess, for it not to be. I guess, I mean, part of this is that I have no faith in MSNBC ever removing people for the right reasons.
No,
You know, so, and he really, I mean, some of Chris Matthews' greatest hits. I just found this out or else I would have tried to do a montage.
Yeah.
Nando, these are my two favorites. Everyone knows this. I love Chris Matthews, and I love Ryan.
Now, Chris Matthews, you're an expert in politics.
You're so good at this, Nando.
You worked for Tip O'Neill. Tell me what you're seeing. Well, Brad, it's very interesting. It's like the Hitler invasion. That's
really good. That's really good. But it's like... I can't do it, but Chris Matthews, oh, you worked for Tip O'Neill, the great unifier, as they used to call him. He just sounds so dumb. I can't do the impersonation right, and I realize that the content of my impersonation really sucks too. So just pretend I hadn't done that and rewind back to Nando's good impersonation. And now I'll redeem myself by playing actual footage, which is the only thing I'm apparently good at. Wow, that went dark really fast.
Okay, yeah, seriously.
Foremost, Chris Matthews, I know you as a romantic about American politics.
It's exactly like what I figured he would be saying.
Exactly.
I happen to know Joy Reid is with you. Ditto. She is a romantic about the American political experience. I am guessing you are both by now
in love
for realists that we're looking at a category that says reallocated preference. What is going on here, and is this any way to pick a nominee?
Whoa.
Well, I don't think so, but it's the way we're picking this one, and it looks like Bernie Sanders is hard to beat right now. I'm with Carville all the way in terms of the dangers of what lies ahead in November. I'm very much aware of them. They're sitting on so much Oppo research on Bernie, what he said in the past about world affairs, how far left he is. I'm not sure how far left he is, but they're going to make the most of that in terms of world politics. They're going to kill him. But I think it's a little late to stop him. And I think that's the problem.
I like that.
I was reading last night, Brian. I know you're a history guy.
Here it comes.
Reading last night about the fall of France in the summer of 1940. And the general, Renault, calls up Churchill and says, it's over. And Churchill said, how can it be? You got the greatest army in Europe. How can it be over? He said, it's over. So I had that suppressed feeling. I can't be as wild as Carville, but he is damn smart. And I think he's damn right on this one.
It's
heartbreaking.
Like, remember those days? Yeah, those days felt good.
I mean,
they weren't that long ago. It's wild to watch these videos now of like the elite mainstream media just like having a total meltdown. over Bernie just steamrolling the field. what happened after Ben, it's so sad.
I know, it is sad. The only thing, again, the only thing I'm sad about is that I wish that Nazi invasion.
Well, the Nazis ended up losing.
The Nazis ended up losing in real life. And in this metaphor, I mean, I don't want to, look, I should reject the whole premise, but I wish Matthews had been right.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah. I can't, that just brought a tear to my eye.
I know, when they were so scared.
Yeah, it was great. It felt so good. It just felt so good to watch them squirm. You know, like, people don't understand that half of Trump's appeal is that he makes people like Chris Matthews and the awful libs like go crazy and burn their hair on fire every time he says something.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I gotta admit, it is satisfying to watch them go crazy. Like, obviously it's more satisfying when Bernie does it.
And it's a good guy, yeah.
But that's a huge part of the appeal, because everybody hates these people. Everybody. Like, outside of you know, upscale suburban wine moms, everybody hates all of these people.
Yeah, it's awful. And it's making me sad. I'm remembering all those terrible things when Chris Matthews said that they were going to be executions in Central Park. And Chris Hayes, to his credit, was like, well, no, that's not true. We know where his politics are.
I don't know who Bernie supports over these years. I don't know what he means by social. One week it's Denmark. We're going to be like Denmark. Okay, that's harmless. That's basically a capitalist country with a lot of good social welfare programs. Denmark is harmless.
He's pretty clearly in the Denmark category, yeah.
Are you sure? How do you know? Did he tell you that?
Well, I mean, that's what he says, and that's what his agenda calls for, right? He's not calling for anything.
Let's figure that one out.
But we haven't seen a campaign yet where video of him praising the other version, right, which is Castro, has been used.
Well, but that
will be used.
That's a question.
We haven't seen how that plays.
Of how tender, what the effect that has.
Well, what does he think of Castro? That's a great question. What did you think of Fidel Ismo? We all thought he was great when he first. I thought he was cheering like mad for him when he first went in. And then he became a communist and started shooting every one of his enemies.
Okay, hold those thoughts on the Cuban Revolution.
And, you know, that argument is so disingenuous. He made it and Joy Ann Reid made it, which is like, well, the right is definitely going to use that. Like, of course they're going to use that. And look at, like, Hunter Biden.
Yeah.
They're
not going to use that one.
Yeah. It's like, it's just so incredibly selective and it's so disingenuous. Like, they're just being the realists, right? That that Ryan Williams knows them to be. And the idea is
you're
that
you're romantic about U.S. politics.
He's so annoying. He's the worst. Yeah. So I don't know, though. Here's the question. Who's worse, Joanne Reed on Bernie or
absolutely Joanne Reed. Absolutely, okay. Joanne Reed. 100%. Well, because we have to go back to the whole reason why we watched this video in the first place, which we haven't told, is that there's legitimate breaking news.
Yes, here's the breaking news. Ready? Drum roll, please. Chris Matthews is being replaced by fellow Bernie hater Joanne Reed.
Yes. So everyone was looking at that 7 p.m. time slot at MSNBC. You know, it's prime time. It's the first hour of prime time, but it's still prime time. And it was open. And now it's going to Joanne Reed, who in any functioning society would have been expelled from any position of influence or power. I mean, as a journalist, to do what she did and then basically tweet through it, right? I mean, she famously, when she was young, as a blogger for the Miami Herald of all places, she wrote like some insanely homophobic things, which in and of itself is bad. But like, if she would have apologized and moved on, it was legitimately a different era. Like the early 2000s, that kind of thing was just out there a lot more. And I think we should allow for growth from people.
Yeah,
and all that
evolution.
Stuff. Like,
I think,
yeah, like, yeah. It's that's how progress happens. People change, people learn, and all that stuff. We shouldn't like cancel her for something that she said when she was young. The problem was that she lied, said that she was hacked
by the Ruskies,
and that those blog posts were not written by her. And it's just insane that she was able to get away with that. And then people were just like, yep, I believe it. Let's move on. You know, and now she's being rewarded. I mean, it's just I can't begin to describe like how rotten our supposed meritocracy is when you're a journalist and you're supposed to be pursuing the truth. That is your literal job, is to pursue the best version of the truth that you can get to and inform the millions of people who you have a platform for.
about the truth, and then to just blatantly lie about something like that. I mean, another one is Brian Williams, right, who just straight up lied about being shot at while he was on a helicopter, and it was right. bullshit. And now he's back somehow.
Although, you know what? He did get disciplined. Like, he got fired and then rehired.
He got fired. He was the nightly news anchor for NBC, and he was the most watched news anchor in America. And he got removed from that post and replaced with Lester Holt. But it's like a thing. It's like, you know, he got put on in timeout, and now he's back hosting a primetime show on MSNBC.
Yeah.
And hosts all their main political coverage.
So I mean, boring. But the thing that's really on top of that, the sad thing about that whole Brian Williams thing is that what's really pathetic is that he's basically the person who got into the most trouble for any Iraq related lies. Right. Like he's the only
he got in trouble for stealing valor. You don't get in trouble for killing Iraqis. You get in trouble for stealing troop valor. Like, you know, the troops are still sacred. Even though, right. like,
so if Trump you lie and you pretend
made fun of a dead troop's mom, and that should have ended that thing. But yeah, you can't steal valor and get away with it. That's much harder to get away with.
Right, exactly. So as long as you could have as much Iraqi blood on your hands as you'd like.
Yeah. I mean, Jeffrey Goldberg published a cover story in which he said that Iraq and Al-Qaeda worked together to do 9/11.
Right.
Which is a total lie. Iraq had nothing to do. Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. And now he's the editor of The Atlantic, the most prestigious liberal magazine in America.
Right. Which, by the way, came up with broken windows theory.
They came up with that?
The Atlantic was where that piece about broken windows theory was published first, was in The Atlantic. Now, I just want to play. Because we referred to that to Joanne Reed. I mean, she's done so much. She's lied and pretended she had been hacked, which really is quite stunning. I mean, it is absolutely stunning.
It's absolutely stunning. It contributes to the feeling of unreality that so much of us feel in 2020, right? Where like nothing.
The feeling of unreality.
The feeling of unreality that Joanne Reed brings to the table is something that she's going to be delivering to you people at the 7 o'clock hour every night here on this network.
So great. Thank you so much. Really, this is so good. I love it. One of my favorite Joanne Reed appearances was when she had a real expert on the show. She really went the full distance.
Body language.
Yes. So let's look at this. Ready? Joanne Reed, do that due diligence, show that professionalism for which we adore her so much.
Scandals hurt you more when they seem plausible, right?
Right.
I mean, Bernie Sanders does have a sort of physicality, you know, when he talks.
By the way, I forgot to set this up. So this is after Pocahontas. What's her name? Warren. Elizabeth Powwow Chow. Liz Holio Warren, big structural Bailey. She basically treated her dog the way Sarah Palin treated her newborn. Which was exploited
as a political prop. Yeah,
as a political prop, and kept him up way past his bedtime. what was his name? Trig. Yeah, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I wonder how
Andrew Sullivan was obsessed with that story, like in a really creepy way. Yeah, he was like, Trig. Like Trig was like the biggest political prisoner in America.
So he was anti. Okay, he felt like it was. Got it. He was on the right.
Palin.
He was on the right side of history, but maybe
he hated
not
Palin right. probably for misogyny.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Whoa, Nando, am I gonna have to cancel you?
Probably.
All right. It's okay. I think we should also announce who we want to cancel. Every show, we should come up with five people. We'll take suggestions from guys. Yeah. If you want a super chat, if you want to pay us, we will take your. We'll
cancel
your money.
Whoever you want.
Yeah, we will cancel the highest bidders. We are mercenaries, and we're willing to cancel.
I'll sell my cancel bullets.
Yeah.
To the highest bidder. I got five of them each show.
Yeah. So basically, I got to go back to this. This clip. So this is when Powwow Chow recipe contributor, and that's a reference to when she lied and pretended she was Cherokee, and not just that, as if that's not bad enough, but she stole a recipe that was, I think, French, and contributed to a cookbook called Powwow Chow.
It was developed in the French and Indian War. Everyone knows that.
Oh, really?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, I'm so gullible. Like the ratio of my gullibility to my sarcasm is very, it's
very bizarre. It's part of your charm there.
I guess it is. Yeah. So here is Joanne Reed and a body language expert, and they are trying to figure out if Bernie was lying or Elizabeth Warren was lying. Oh, wow. That's really hard. One of them has a real interesting, troubled relationship with the truth. The other one is so fucking honest that it's off-putting to some people. Like, show me where Bernie has lied or like said something. Yeah. I mean, has anyone ever said that he's lied?
No, they've never really caught him in a lie. Yeah, not like that.
Maybe like Sally Albright did, because she's, we got to look at her tweets later. I love watching her lose her mind. Okay, you're right. That's trigger warning. Okay, so here's the clip. I just need to set it up. So basically, this is when Elizabeth Warren lied and said that Bernie Sanders had told her that a woman couldn't win, which obviously wasn't what happened. Clearly, I'm sure he was like, look, Trump's going to use whatever he can use. You know, he's a misogynist. He's going to use that. You know,
which is totally different. Yeah.
Which is totally different. I'm sure that's what he said.
1,000% the truth.
And 1,000% truth. I mean, I was waiting for her to say like, Bernie told me I couldn't win because I'm a Native American.
Here's the thing. He said I couldn't win because I'm too dumb because I'm a woman.
Southern. She's not that Southern though.
She sometimes talks like that.
Mama.
Yeah.
Mama.
When she talks about like her, you know, Native American past in Oklahoma, she talks like that.
Yeah. You're right. I guess she does. Okay. Yeah. So this is when she lied basically, and Bernie Sanders, during the debate, they totally set him up. It was ridiculous. Bernie Sanders said, no, I didn't say that to her. I didn't tell her that a woman couldn't win.
Senator Sanders, CNN reported yesterday Senator Warren confirmed in a statement that in 2018, you told her that you did not believe that a woman could win the election. Why did you say that?
Well, as a matter of fact, I didn't say it. And I don't want to waste a whole lot of time on this because this is what Donald Trump and maybe some of the media want. Anybody knows me knows that it's incomprehensible that I would think that a woman could not be president of the United States. Go to YouTube today. There's a video of me 30 years ago talking about how a woman could become president of the United States. In 2015, I deferred, in fact, to Senator Warren. There was a movement to draft Senator Warren to run for president. And you know what? I stayed back. Senator Warren decided not to run, and I did. I did run afterwards. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million votes. How could anybody in a million years not believe that a woman could become president of the United States? And let me be very clear. If any of the women on this stage or any of the men on this stage win the nomination, I hope that's not the case. I hope it's me. But if they do, I will do everything in my power to make sure that they are elected in order to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of our country.
So, Senator Sanders, I do want to be clear here. You're saying that you never told Senator Warren that a woman could not win the election.
That is correct.
And then the debate woman was like, okay, thank you. Senator Warren, what did you think? What did it feel like when Bernie Sanders said that to you?
Senator Warren, what did you think when Senator Sanders told you a woman could not win the election?
It was like unbelievable. So now Joanne Reed, because she's such a truth teller, whether it's lying about being hacked by Russians who went into the Wayback Machine somehow, and even though all tech experts say it's impossible, somehow I guess they are pretty devious, they hacked into it.
Someone just tweeted at us that this is the longest setup ever.
I mean, yeah, you're welcome, guys. You're welcome. In fact, I should someone better get on Super Chat and
pledge some money. All right, fine. Episode.
All right, ready? I'm going to play it.
All right.
I hope you guys get it.
Scandals hurt you more when they seem plausible, right?
Right.
I mean, Bernie Sanders does have a sort of physicality, you know, when he talks, that is a shaking your finger at Hillary Clinton, shaking your finger, shovey, weirdy.
His
physicality makes me think, he could have said, you know, listen, I think in this environment, a woman can't win. That doesn't seem like a crazy thing.
Well, first of all, I think Bernie's lying. We see him, he slouches forward anyway, Joy, but here he turtles. If you look at his eye level where he normally answers these questions. When he makes the denial, his whole shoulders come up like a little kid getting caught. His eye level is below his shoulders. This is trying to hide in plain sight. And many of us, we don't know what to look for. So if you look for this right out of the gate, and the strongest denial is simply saying no. And I think women in particular, we want to believe human beings. Mm. So we're like, yeah, I would say that. Mm. He literally said, well, as a matter of fact, I didn't say it. That's 9 words. Unnecessary. No. Did you vote for Donald Trump in the last election?
Absolutely no.
Right? So no. Did you dress up as an Easter bunny on Easter?
Absolutely no.
Right? So it's no. We say no. Absolutely is actually not the strongest denial. You're playing with me here in the game, but at least you're getting the no in here. We're not hearing the no with Bernie. Also with Bernie, he has numerous hotspots. He says, well, mm-hmm. liars like to start with, well, he looks away. He laughs. I think he might have been coached to laugh in this moment. A lot of politicians are coached to laugh in the difficult times. So we're focused on the laughter, and it's supposed to send a message that this isn't serious. It is serious.
First of all, she looks like a fucking seahorse who's about to tip over. Why? Do you see the thing? And like, yeah. Look how forward she is. That's not body shaming. Yeah. There's nothing problematic about that. It's just her position. I don't know why she's doing that. She's so eager to attack.
Katie, you're of the Semitic persuasion, correct?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Do you think?
Physical.
Yeah, is this not like a?
Oh my god, it's total. It's ridiculous. Like
talking him out, talking shit about him for finger wagging seems like an anti-Semitic.
His physicality.
And talking shit about him for slouching is like blatant ageism. My god, like look at any old person; they all slouch.
It's ridiculous, right? I know. But here's my favorite part. I don't know if you guys caught this, but Joanne Reed is not giving her the answer that she wants. Right. Her whole point, Madam Seahorse, her whole point is that
just to say no.
Yeah. You just say no. Right. You just say no. And then Joanne Reed is like, absolutely not. Or absolutely no. Like, and she's like, I know you're playing.
Totally lied. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know. Also, the fact that Joanne Reed can just like even begin to judge this and no one's being like, it's kind of inappropriate because you are a documented liar. You shouldn't judge this, but let's just watch that thing again. It's really beautiful. This
absolutely
part of it
is actually not the strongest denial. But we're like, yeah, I would say that. He literally said, well, as a matter of fact, I didn't say it. That's 9 words. Unnecessary. No. Did you vote for Donald Trump in the last election?
Absolutely no.
Right? So no. Did you dress up as an Easter bunny?
She laughed.
Absolutely. Oh my god.
So it's
He was coached to laugh. We gotta watch all the clips where she starts with well.
Katie, you should do like every single, you should just do like an anti-Joy Reed broadcast every single night. Just like fact check her show.
I need you there, Nando. Look at that. You're the one.
Do the anti-Joy Reed show.
Yeah.
You know, I think you could rack up the views on that one.
Misery Reed.
Yeah.
Misery Reed.
I got it. Yeah, I got
no,
it.
We say no. Absolutely is actually not the strongest denial.
But you're playing with me.
Playing with me here in the game. But at least you're getting the no in here. We're not hearing the no with Bernie. Also with Bernie, he has numerous hotspots. He says, well. Liars like to start with well. He looks away. He laughs. I think he might have been coached to laugh in this moment. A lot of politicians are coached to laugh in the difficult times.
Is she Canadian or Midwestern?
So we're focused on the laughter, and it's supposed to send a message that this isn't serious. It is serious. If he said it, which I believe that he did, he would have been better to just own it.
Okay.
Well, our media is the most embarrassing media by far in the world. I mean, the thing is like with like all these like authoritarian regimes in which they have state media and stuff, they're embarrassing, but it's like understandable. And like they, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you don't want them to get killed, right?
Right, yeah. These people just do it out of their own volition. It's really pathetic.
Yeah, it's really pathetic. You guys, welcome to the resistance media. This woman is going to be guiding you through the news. And she's not even entertaining like Chris Matthews, who is entertaining.
No, Chris Matthews is hilarious. His obsession with Tip O'Neill and bipartisanship is the funniest thing ever. Like, it's just, it's so quaint and outside. Yeah, it's very sexual. I mean, he had like a genuine like sexual reaction to Barack Obama. And you remember like his famous clip when he was like, I felt the chill going up my leg. It went straight up my inner thigh and then up my, you know, like, it's like, whoa, dude.
Is that when he also said he forgot he was black or something?
Yeah. He had like a weird thing with Obama. Yeah, it was definitely really weird.
He's like, tonight I forgot what... I can't do it, but tonight I forgot he was black.
Yeah.
it was amazing. We are going to bring in our guest. We're very excited, guys. And her name is none other than Julia Salazar. Julia,
welcome. Hi.
Entonces, ¿qué, Julia? ¿Usted cómo está?
Bien.
Muy bien. Katie, you got to learn the Colombian accent.
Okay, I see. That's pretty good, right? No, that's more Peruvian. I had a Colombian boyfriend.
Yeah.
Nice.
And you know what his name was, guys?
Andrés Restrepo.
No.
Or Camilo. Camilo no. Villegas.
No, his name was Jorge Enrique. The nickname for which is Quique. And it's usually spelled Q-U-I-Q-U-E, right? Yeah. But I had the great fortune of having a boyfriend who spelled
K-I-K-E.
It.
K-I-K-E, yeah.
K-I-K-E. Do you guys know what that looks like in texts?
Yes.
Probably some of you don't know. Some viewers out there, you probably don't know, and that's okay. But it is a, it's an old-fashioned anti-Semitic slur. So it was very fun to say that. So Julia, congratulations on your victory.
Yes.
Thank you.
Is this, I mean, I almost feels like a retroactive Katie Helper Show bump.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not because I was, no, it's a pure Katie Helper Show
bump. Yeah, you're right. If we go back to the first one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We already got some love for you. We got Eric, who was proud to vote for you yesterday, Senator.
Is it like forever now, like until, you know, you're 90 years old, we have to refer to you as Senator Salazar? Like, even if you retire from the Senate, like you get the title for the rest of your life.
Well, I'll say this. I won't require that you call me Senator, but even Senator DeLon, I still call him Senator DeLon. I still call him Senator if I see him, and I defeated him. So
there you go.
That should answer the question. Even someone who you made sure is no longer a senator. I don't think that they strip you of the title. You're just a former senator.
You made sure he's no longer a senator. It's a good,
Call him. You should call him. Hi, I made sure you weren't a senator, DeLon. How are you?
Hello, former Senator DeLon.
Hi, guy I replaced. Yeah.
Disrespectful.
Yeah. So tell us about, again, congrats, and tell us about your election, and tell us about how this fits into the general, not the general election, but the broader election scene, as political scientists call it, I believe, the broader election scene. But tonight, last night's primaries, Tuesday night's primaries.
Yeah. So since 2018, many more people have decided to run as insurgent candidates in Democratic primaries, which is really cool, especially in New York. And more, you know, we've seen many more people become involved in local politics. We saw in 2018 a huge increase in turnout, especially in my district, more than any state Senate district in the state. This year, we didn't really see the turnout that we would have wanted to see, but it was also actually still higher than most districts across the state. And we'll have a better idea of what the turnout was once the absentee ballots are counted, which won't even be counted until July 1st. So we're all going to have to wait at least a week to actually know for sure what the results of the election are. Some of the races, including my own, were decisive. I think we can say the same about Jabari Brisport, who ran as a DSA endorsed, a DSA member. I also supported him, ran in the district directly south of me in Brooklyn. He did extremely well in a three-way race with, it was for an open seat, but one of the candidates had been in the assembly for a long time. So it was sort of a similar dynamic to running in a race with an incumbent. But what's really important is that the same movement that elected myself and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other Democratic socialists to state legislatures around the country for the first time in 2018 saw victories last night, and we'll probably be able to confirm that in about a week from now. I didn't have a very competitive race, but I did have a challenger from the right.
You're flexing so hard in a very humble way. Yeah.
Well, I mean, for what it's worth, I think my race was less interesting than a lot of the other races, but I didn't have a very formidable opponent it's just real. It's just real. This guy's like kind of an anti-vaxxer.
Nice.
Actually, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was interesting. You know, formerly like supported Trump, but ran as Democrat.
Nice.
Yeah, really a very interesting choice in a district that elected a Democratic Socialist before. So,
right. Yeah. Especially like your first election was like a slugfest, you know, like I'll never forget that. That is ingrained in my mind. I was like genuinely terrified of just, and now it must feel good to just go up against some loser anti-vaxxer who like probably believes in, I don't know, like, you know, chemtrails or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, he believes in a lot of interesting things. I think, honestly, I think it would be nice to have a normal opponent, or someone.
The best gig is to not have an opponent. Come on.
Yeah, that's also true. That's also true. But to not have an opponent that's like a vestige of the Vita Lopez political machine, which was the case in 2018 and this time around. But hopefully, I don't know. I'm hoping that people who really genuinely care about policy and public service will start running for office more as we're seeing, you know, business as usual machine politics not win elections anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Julia, tell us about the other people who won. Then I want to talk to you more about your campaign and also what you've achieved as state senator, because you really have done a lot of really exciting things. So which races were you the most excited about besides your own? Which other victories were you excited about? And which ones were you, which non-victories were you disappointed about? But, you know, cautiously optimistic, because people lose a lot at the beginning until they, like St. Bernard lost a bunch of times at first.
Yeah. St. Bernard. Well, I was really excited about all of the candidates that our local DSA chapter endorsed. We ran multiple candidates for assembly against Democratic incumbents. Those races are still largely undecided, but Zofran Mamdani, who ran in Queens, it did very well. Depending on the absentee ballots, I think he has a very good chance of winning that seat. You know, the only state Senate Democratic Socialist who ran aside from myself was Jabari, which is really awesome that I'm going to have a new colleague because I've been the only Socialist in the state Senate the past couple of years. I was really, you know, one thing that I was disappointed to see was Samely Lopez ran a really inspiring campaign.
Yeah.
She really hustled and had a lot of grassroots support. But I think because there were a lot of candidates, you know, there were like 12 candidates on the ballot in that race.
That Data for Progress poll did her dirty. That was.
Oh, what did he do?
He released a poll like a week or two ago, putting her at 2%. You know, which was nowhere near what she ended up getting. Fired from where? He owns the fucking thing.
I'm firing him.
We're canceling him.
Buy. What can I buy shares in Data Progress?
Probably not.
Maybe.
Okay, I'm canceling him. I'm firing him.
Stage a coup in the board.
I'm going to join the board. Yeah. No, but that's bullshit, because that's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Totally.
Right? It's so annoying. It's like, oh, that person's just not viable. Okay, I'm not going to vote for
her. And polling in these like little races like that is wildly unreliable. We didn't know, like Ocasio-Cortez, like when she won, we didn't know what the fuck was going to happen until election night. Like no one knew. Same with Engel and Bowman. We didn't fucking know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and we're going to get to that soon. You know what? I'm going to call him out. Sean McElwee.
Yeah.
McAlley, whatever. I'm sorry. No disrespect to my Irish brothers and sisters.
For what it's worth, like, a lot of people were bringing up where Richie stood on the Right to Know Act. There were a lot of advocates people who I used to work with within the Community for Police Reform Coalition before I ran for office. Who really felt that he had betrayed them at the end of those negotiations over the legislation, and rightfully so, right? He ended up amending his bill in the final hour. This legislation that we had fought years for to try to minimize the number of unlawful encounters and unconstitutional encounters between civilians and the police in New York. So basically, there was already bad blood between a lot of people on the left and Richie Torres. So I was a little bit surprised that that wasn't reflected. But, you know, there's at least a grain of truth in the logic that you see that a lot of people sort of drew from the Data for Progress poll, which was like, if it came down to Richie Torres or Ruben Diaz, Richie is far and beyond the better candidate,
right?
Be a better congressman. But frankly, that, you know, we should reject that dichotomy, especially when there are 12 candidates in a race and we have a candidate as inspiring as Semeles. Oh, there
yeah.
you go.
Yeah, got it, baby.
Got my
high
support.
Nice. Great.
Nice.
Great yeah. cop.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, this is just, I had to find this tweet from Ross Barkin where he said, gotta love Sean McElwee calling Richie Torres an AOC style progressive here. Dude literally disavows DSA, supported the leader of the IDC, and is proudly pro-Israel.
Yeah.
So, yeah, shame on you, Sean, and shame on Data Progress. And if I ever contributed to them, which I don't, I would stop. And I'm just canceling them, and they're all, whatever. I mean, I like your Abolish ICE t-shirt, Sean. That was good, but you should have stopped there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Richie Torres, by the way, so that was the race against Ruben Diaz, senior, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I got to say, I'm a little conflicted because while I don't like his politics, I respect a good cowboy hat.
Yeah. Latin cowboy hat guy. Yeah.
I mean, that's bold. That is like that. Not every man has the security is secure enough in his manlyhood to do that. So
I'm not. I certainly
you're not. Yeah. Well, no. Also, you're not Latinx, Nando.
I'm not Latinx.
Spaniard. You are
I'm
a Spaniard.
An imperialist pig.
Yeah. I mean, I like pigs, so I don't actually. But
is that is that what you claim?
Imperialist pig.
Yeah.
Do you imperialist pig identify?
Yeah. Yeah. I self-ID as an imperialist pig.
And I just want to give people the chance to see the man I'm talking about. This is Ruben Diaz, senior. Yes.
We're going to provide a photo identification.
Photo op. This is a nice one.
Suspense.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't realize that he wore the cowboy hat.
And I really like Semeles. And also Semeles was like great on foreign policy. She talked. In fact, you can see my interview with her. I had her on and I had Assad Haider on. And Semeles talked about the her humanistic international policy, foreign policy. Yeah. Oh, look at the whole fam. Look, he's never without it.
Yeah.
His cowboy hat. And he also, that's a cute baby there, though. He also drove around, Ted Cruz was being driven around the Bronx. That was Ruben Diaz who accompanied him.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, shout out to Semeles. And as I told Semeles on the show, I mean, I think if the Katie Halper show hadn't been mitigated by Sean.
Yeah.
I think she would have sailed through.
Yeah.
But which is another reason I absolutely am out to cancel Sean. In fact, why don't we have a hashtag? KT helps cancel.
We're gonna abolish Data for
Data
Progress.
For Progress. I'm gonna make a t-shirt that says that. Yeah. Abolish DFP. Tell us please about the Bowman upset. That was amazing.
Yeah. That was incredible. Jamal Bowman, and that was actually an example. Someone pointed this out that in some of these races, you had, I can think of at least a couple of an assembly district in South Brooklyn, Assemblyman Felix Ortiz's district, right, where there were two or three progressive challengers. And, you know, Jamal Bowman challenged Congressman Engel. And there was another challenger with pretty comparable policy stances to Jamal's. And similarly, we saw in South Brooklyn a race where Marcela Mitenis ran, Hennessy Sacchino, Catherine Walsh. They all ran against Felix Ortiz. And it really appears based on like the electoral map and also the way their endorsements were spread out that the left wasn't able to galvanize around one candidate. And the result was that an incumbent who was to the right of all of them was able to just, you know, sail into the seat again. In the case of Jamal challenging Congressman Engel, a third challenger, right, Andem, who was also in the race before, he ended his campaign and endorsed Jamal a matter of, I think it was only a few weeks ago, maybe less than that. The past couple of weeks have felt really long in the electoral world. But it was very recently that he did, and he did that knowing, you know, that it was unlikely that he would be able to win. And what, you know, he recognized it was more important that a truly progressive candidate fighting for transformative policies would be able to win. And sure enough, you know, I think it made a difference. And who knows, maybe Jamal would have won even in a three-way race. But it was a rare example of the left closing ranks. And
like the libs did with Bernie.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, or right.
Yeah.
Sort of the opposite of what we wanted, but
yeah, exactly.
This time it benefited the left, but
the consolidation, usually moderate consolidation, this was leftist consolidation.
I mean, one thing that I think is interesting about this moment in New York is that progressives across the board who were running ran really strong absentee campaigns and really encouraged people to submit absentee ballots. It also, you know, there was almost no, what they called no excuse absentee voting, because anyone could just check that they had been impacted or were concerned about coronavirus and therefore would be able to vote absentee. And we also were testing out for the first time the new election laws that we passed at the state level in 2019, in early 2019. So expanding early voting and also making absentee voting easier. And therefore, you know, in the past, absentee ballots typically, for example, with Tiffany Caban's campaign, a lot of people are still a little bit traumatized by the outcome of counting the absentee ballots after election night with that, right? Because I think, you know, it's like something like 50 votes was ultimately the margin that gave
Melinda Katz
the victory, right? I think that we're going to see different results. It's difficult to predict, but we're going to see more progressives votes counted in those absentee ballots on July 1st. So it could actually swing some of these elections, such as in Zohran's race. You know, it could really secure his victory over an incumbent. It could even, you know, push Marcela Metinus over the edge and be able to defeat an incumbent in her race as well. So it's, you know, we'll see. It's different than an election that we've seen before.
And Julia, when you go to like Albany and stuff, do you like, when you like write a law, what do you do? Like, do you like fire up Microsoft Word and just like start writing? How does it work? I've never like known a politician in my life.
I mean, we have incredibly, you know, smart and competent counsel in the central staff of the state Senate. And we also are all assigned bill drafters. So it can take a lot of different forms. I generally, if I have an idea about legislation or if one of my constituents has an idea for legislation, then, you know, I seek their input as much as possible, even welcome them to draft a bill with my office. I also have a legislative director who is really amazing. He's actually in his other life outside of the Senate. He's a criminal defense attorney, and a comrade. And he's brilliant and really great to work with. So he helps me tremendously in drafting legislation. Then I also have an assigned bill drafter. It can look like me submitting a bill that's virtually in its final form, or I can just sort of like throw something together, submit it to the bill drafter,
nice.
Say like, can you make sure that this is constitutional and like poke holes in it and make sure that it's sound. And then they'll get us a bill draft. We'll say, okay, we're ready to submit it. And then it's a bill.
Because I'm assuming these awful, corrupt, you know, people who've been there forever, just hand a piece of paper to like some real estate developer and is like, here, write the bill and I'll just submit it. So it's that's something I think about a lot. Like, you know, hey, let's get into politics and get like a leftist into politics, whatever. Like, but then you have to like actually do the thing. And it sounds so hard. And I think that that's just a huge barrier for people to jump in.
Yeah.
You know, that might be. So it's cool to hear you, you know, talk about all that stuff.
It's a little easier than it looks. And also, you know, one thing that I found coming in a new Democratic majority after the Democrats in the state Senate hadn't been in power and hadn't controlled the chamber in a long time is that we were I was new and a little self-conscious about being new and being the youngest member of the Senate. And what I found was that everyone is just winging it all the time.
Well, that's true of politics as it is with corporate America. Like I've worked at, you know, some of the biggest companies in America and stared into the belly of the beast of the highest levels. And like, you know, some VP of whatever the fuck who's making like a bajillion dollars, like has no idea what he's doing and is just winging it half the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like emboldening. It's depressing, but also ultimately maybe empowering, right?
It is. You have to get rid of your imposter syndrome. I'm not talking about you personally. I'm talking about
It's
fine.
Yeah. Nando, you should be a coach, a lifestyle.
I'm very good at this.
You're very good at like women. I feel like you're good at.
I'm good at women.
You're good at understanding like the shit women face, I feel like, you know what I mean? Like maybe because you have a sister.
Yes.
And a mom.
Yes. I think my sister might be watching. Shout out, Elisa.
Hi, Elisa. Hey. How are you? We got to have her on.
Yeah. She's way cooler than me, to be honest.
I mean, I'm trying this, the whole plan, the whole idea here is, the Elisa plan.
To increase her female viewership.
I do, yeah. Yeah, I need to, yeah. You guys look a lot alike. It's really cute. Oh, I see. Oh, another joke about Nana being good looking. All right, we got to have a drinking game where we drink every time someone says that. Someone being me or my guest. I know this seems to be a Nando exploitation free zone.
It's okay.
You must be really triggered by it, right?
No, I'm okay. I can survive.
I'll run my social media while I do this, by the way. I'll talk to anyone want to do that, let me know. Because I'm like trying to tweet out and Instagram out and it gets very distracting. I won't do that. Think of your mom and sister. Thank you, Ben Gordon. So, Julia, I wanted to know what you've been able to achieve as a state senator. Let's start with that.
Yeah. Well, I feel really fortunate to have come into the state Senate at the moment that I did when.
Oh, wait, sorry, Julia, can you raise your volume at all or come closer to the mic?
Oh, yep.
Listen to women. How's that?
Yes. How is that? I don't know.
Eric, how is that?
Maybe more.
I like the request implies I have some major like tech operation here where I'm like, let me just raise the senator 30%. I think that's okay. What do you guys think? Good?
I can hear me.
I can hear you.
Yeah.
Great.
Way to undermine Julia. She can hear herself.
So, I mean, I came into the state Senate at a really fortunate moment when I was able to join the conference that then had control of the chamber. And if I had come in the minority, then naturally it would be very difficult for me to pass legislation. So coming into a Democratic controlled state Senate and Democratic controlled assembly with a Democratic governor made it easier for me to pass something like 25 bills in just a year and a half that I introduced.
It's huge.
Yeah, no, it's good. the first bill that I passed when I got into the state Senate was something called the CCCA, the Comprehensive Contraception Care Act. It's kind of a tongue twister, but it expands access to contraception across the state of New York. So there's no more cost sharing. No insurance plan can charge anyone to fill their birth control prescription, and it applies to all of the many FDA approved forms of contraception, which, you know, I got to like have a little bit of internal debate with our Republican colleagues across the aisle about the intimate details of using these different types of contraception. So
wait, what?
just having
it goes in the V.
Vaginal condom is, you know,
vaginal condom. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And why it should be free for someone to be able to get at the pharmacy, or get through their doctor. So that was interesting. And then, you know, what was most exciting for me was being a part of passing these really transformative rent laws in 2019. It really had motivated my run for office in the first place, that I represent a district where it's been disproportionately harmed by gentrification, and by the housing crisis. A lot of families who have been in North Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, especially in Bushwick, for a long time, for generations, are being pushed out. And it's because until last year, there were these loopholes essentially in the rent laws that would allow for landlords to permanently destabilize apartments and push people out, raise the rents, and make buildings and units permanently unaffordable for people who have lived in our neighborhoods for a long time. So I fought for this package of 9 bills, really led by, for the first time, this statewide coalition to finally, improve the policies for people who live in rent-regulated apartments. And then I introduced a bill called the Good Cause Eviction Bill, which we are still fighting to pass, which would essentially implement a form of universal rent control across the state of New York. But we've been gaining co-sponsors. We have a solid majority of co-sponsors in the Senate on the bill. So it's just a matter of continuing to fight to make sure that leadership brings the bill to the floor. And it's really a critical moment to be doing that, because so many people haven't been able to afford to pay their rent for months. And what was already a crisis in our communities has really been exacerbated by the public health crisis.
Yeah. Does that make you feel, I mean, it's very frightening. I'm not in New York City. I feel very distanced from it and very spoiled and like privileged, but, I could see how this crisis would make you like scared of politics, but it could also make you realize how urgent they are. Have you faced or felt or experienced more frustration and, despair and hopelessness, or more, hope, I guess, or combo?
Yeah, definitely a combo. I have really been encouraged by people in our communities coming together and forming mutual aid networks to make up for, frankly, the failure of the federal government to provide enough assistance to New York right now. Amidst, on the one hand, it's absolutely devastating that we've lost almost 5,000 people in Brooklyn to the virus, and it's a lot of it has been in communities I represent, like in East New York and Brownsville, Bushwick and Bed-Stuy. Our safety net hospitals have been hit really hard, and it was inspiring though to see in a moment like this, when at the same time the governor was trying to push through an austerity budget, cut Medicaid funds to hospitals that desperately need it. And this was at the peak of the pandemic. We're not even talking about right now, where thankfully, like, hospitalizations are decreasing and things are starting to get a little bit back to normal. This was at at the worst moment of the pandemic that he was proposing making millions, more than $1 billion actually across the state in Medicaid cuts, right? But we were able to fight back and really rapidly defeat that proposal in order to protect our community. So I've seen people come together to advocate for policy that's good for our communities, but also come together to feed families that are unable to feed themselves right now, and to provide PPE and hand sanitizer to combat the price gouging that was going on, right? So people's material needs are being met by the solidarity that we've been seeing in Brooklyn and across the city. So I think, you know, altogether, it's been inspiring to see people respond to it. And then also, it is pretty shocking that even in a public, really the worst public health crisis that I think we've seen in any of our lifetimes, that it's not enough to motivate people, you know, the very wealthy, entrenched politicians, compromised politicians, to tax, you know, to increase taxes on the rich, to do the things that we know we absolutely need to do in order to save people's lives. Like, it's not a matter of like personal preference.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
it's not ideology.
So you're saying you're not a Cuomo sexual.
No, I'm not a Cuomo sexual.
Okay. Well, wow. Yeah, it's just, it's really wild. Like, I look at the economic numbers and I'm like, this is the biggest crisis in the history of capitalism. Yeah. At least in 100 years, maybe since capitalism came to be. And the sense that our politics and our elected officials and our ruling class is just pretending like it's not happening is just so disorienting. So to see people like you who are actually trying to do the best you can to like fix this incredibly severe crisis, both on a public health standpoint and as well as an economic standpoint. Like, how does that feel when you're like in Albany dealing with all these people who are just like, yeah, well, I don't know, well, maybe we should just reopen the bars.
Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, I have witnessed people who previously were, you know, before this crisis, not particularly sympathetic to taxing the rich, not really sympathetic to our sort of class struggle politics, right? I've seen them in a very short period of time recognize that it's absolutely necessary. Like, this crisis has it's agitated people, essentially. Mm. It's made people choose which side they're on, the governor not included. but thankfully the problem has not been my colleagues so much, right? I'm seeing the electorate, I think the results of this election are demonstrating that people are ready to support these absolutely essential measures that would have prevented, you know, if we had universal health care, there's no way that we would have lost nearly as many people in the United States as we did, right? And if, you know, if we had a more equitable tax system, we wouldn't have to, in the middle of a pandemic, beg for our public hospitals to be funded, right? Have to, you know, call people in other states and other countries in order to just get the essential PPE for our hospitals, right? Which is something that I've had to do and that my colleagues have had to do. It's completely absurd. I remember, you know, sort of coordinating it and talking to my mom about it. And I'm like, yeah, I had to order PPE from China today for like my local hospital. It's a real thing that a bunch of us have had to do because, and it's unfortunate, especially as a socialist who is at once telling everyone, like, we want the government to be able to provide these basic goods, right? We want to take collective responsibility for this, and yet we're having to like look elsewhere, and not that's what mutual aid is about, but rely on mutual aid networks in order to provide for people's material needs because the government is failing to. And that doesn't, that feels counterintuitive for me as a yeah. socialist, you know?
Right. Well, better mutual aid than charity, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, better than you know, proposals for some corporation to come in and,
right.
and yeah.
Right.
And then
mutual aid has more egalitarian, right, universal and like more rights based, less charity based, more yeah. justice based than like generosity based.
Right.
Framing.
Yeah, not about philanthropy. Yeah.
Right. We have another guest who I'm going to bring on in a couple of seconds. Let me just tell him we're ready.
One, two.
Should we bring him in? Let's bring him in. We're going to bring in our guest. I'm going to say quick hello, and then we're going to give Julie a chance to respond to some of these things. Hi, Ken.
Hey, guys. How's it going, everyone?
Hear us?
What up?
Hi. We're very excited to have journalist Ken Klippenstein. From The Nation. He's also at the Young Turks. He's been published in The Intercept. But based now at The Nation magazine, and a really amazing investigative reporter and making in very exciting news. I mean, this is a real game changer moment, making his Katie Helper show debut. So put that on the top of your bio. Yeah.
He's going to get hired in the New York Times before
yeah.
you know it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Welcome. Yeah. Welcome, Ken.
Hopefully my next job move isn't right in the middle of a global pandemic. I wouldn't recommend
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, everything's online now. So, and Julia Salazar, Ken Klippenstein, I don't know if you guys know each other online or IRL, but you...
online.
Yeah,
I know all you folks from the internet.
Yeah,
it's like internet. We're all living in a Philip Dick novel where we get to see everyone simulated selves.
Yeah, this is an avatar. I don't look like this.
It's like normal now. Yeah. I know. An age where it's totally normal to socialize this way.
Yeah, to social distance, socialize. Yeah. Just want to give some shout outs. We have Elisa was indeed watching. Elisa, sorry, I never know it. I always mispronounce it. Elisa was watching. Hi, Elisa. We got some, I don't know if this is for me or for Julia. It could be, it's on us, guys, as Obama says. And as what's that guy who's the face for that campaign? The guy who played the rapist on, Orange is the New Black.
You know, Matt McGorry.
Matt McGorry was the face of the It's on Us affirmative consent campaign, which I always like.
Yeah.
He turned
into like a good Bernie bro though.
I do like it now.
He evolved.
No, it was a good symbol. That exactly it. It's a sign of evolution. You can evolve from prison guard who has non-consensual relationships with inmates to an ally on affirmative consent, and you can evolve from someone who works with the Obama administration to a Bernie bro. But the question is, will you please relentlessly mock the Democrats who leave legislating halfway through the day to go fundraise and phone bank? And that's a question. I mean, I feel like Julia and Ken, you're both of you are kind of uniquely qualified to address that. Hold on one second. I am we are all social. Well, I don't know. Three quarters of us are socialists here. I don't want to speak for you, but Ken, but I also, we do live in the capitalist world system. So we got to center the voices that pay. Brian Frederick would like to know, does the senator support ranked choice voting?
Yes. Yeah, I do support ranked choice voting. I think it would have been great to see the pilot rolled out. We're going to see it in New York City actually next year, but it would be interesting to see the results of some of these elections if we had had ranked choice voting instead of winner takes all. On the question also about fundraising. It makes the case for public campaign financing because we don't see it as much in the state Senate or in the state legislature, but we do see, right, it's very common for congressional representatives to spend most of their day, actually to spend most of their day, because elections are only every 2 years, fundraising and dialing for dollars or whatever they say. And it's because they're eligible for public matching funds to a certain extent, but it isn't quite what we see at the city level. It's really difficult for people to run a viable campaign. I know you know, I can speak from the experience of running a campaign that rejects all corporate PAC money and any for-profit real estate money. I think that it can be done. The fact that we are seeing more congressional representatives and more state representatives refusing to rely on, you know, huge donors and instead running truly grassroots campaigns is really, it's a good thing. But I try to have some humility about it and recognize that, like, I ran for office for the first time in 2018. And I know that there are people who are really, they need to adjust, but they're used to the way that things used to be, right? In like this traditional way of dialing for dollars and sustaining their campaigns. And we need to demand better.
All right, I agree with that.
Well, if we impose a dictatorship of the proletariat, there would be no need for campaign finance. Because there would be no elections.
Right. Easy. It's unclear what's going to happen first, right?
I don't know if that's... Okay, maybe.
No, speak.
I'm kidding. I don't want to get you in trouble. Disregard that. Delete it.
You don't have to... No, it's okay. We can talk sometime about what it means for there to be a dictatorship of the proletariat, though.
Yeah.
Maybe.
We got to get Assad back on here. Call me an Assadist, if you will. If you must.
What does
Assad hater? Assad hater.
Different Assad.
Oh. Okay.
Different Assad.
Assad hater. Yeah, which is also funny.
Someone will clip that and it'll be. Good.
I know. I mean, it's like the.
Got it.
One of the less positive things I've said about the other one. Just kidding. All right. By the way, I don't know how to see my earlier chats. I'm trying to find someone who chatted earlier, not only because of this, but they did pay. You see, this is all a demonstration of why we need socialism now so that we can have more egalitarian YouTube chats. Julia, we want to give you the chance. If you have any, you can stay. We can drink all night. We can talk all night. You may have some work to do. Want to give you a chance to say goodbye powerfully. Whatever you want. You can sneak away. Whatever you want to do. But you have been with us for a while. We're really grateful.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. And come back.
A pleasure.
Yeah.
I feel like a Katie Halper Show veteran.
Yeah, you are. Of course. Yeah. We had you on. I interviewed you for Teen Vogue. That was fun.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Last question. Okay, last question, though. Does the senator have tips for my dog re-fireworks?
Oh no, I'm so sorry. I guess it kind of depends if you have, like, a place where you can sequester your dog and if you have the time to just spend consoling them. I don't really have tips. I have a puppy who I would go get him, but there's only two rooms in my apartment, and in the other room there are four people. So,
oh, wow. Thank you for
right
sharing
now,
yourself.
They don't live in anywhere.
Right.
So I have a puppy who's only 5 months old. He thankfully is not afraid of fireworks. He doesn't love them, but he doesn't get anxiety about them. But he does get anxiety about some things because he's extremely attached because he's a quarantine puppy.
Oh. You know?
So, I think the only advice I have is that they make these, like, calming treats. I'm going to tell you to give your dog drugs.
Oh, good.
They do.
Yeah.
They make calming these, treats. Like, calming.
It's called Vicodin.
No, it's called
no, it's like valerian root, actually.
Oh, valerian root. Nice.
It's probably what's, like melatonin, maybe. But anyway, they have these treats that are safe for dogs, and it mellows them out a little bit if they have anxiety.
All right, I'll give some to Bodhi.
Yeah. Yeah, try it.
I'll share some photos of you and Bodhi, later on.
The drugs with your dog.
Yeah, dogs like to dabble.
They do.
Just like humans do. All right, thank you so much, Julia.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
That was State Senator Julia Salazar. And Steve Schlesinger, I want to know you to know that I see you. Even though you don't pay for comments, I see you. And good on you for being a social worker. I mean, I'll see you more if you pay a dollar or two, but no, I'm just kidding. Okay, so Ken, thank you so much for joining us. Ken is an amazing investigative journalist, again, at The Nation, and he's written some amazing pieces. I go over the top, but you are a very, very good journalist. And So it's not over the top. You have a recent piece about Elliot Engel that I would love for you to talk about, fresh off the press, hot off the presses. You posted it, you filed it, Tuesday, I believe. And then a piece before that on Antifa, which is very exciting. So let's start with the biggest threat, the bigger threat of those, which is, of course, Elliot Engel. I do want to announce, guys, that I tweeted a couple days ago that people really needed to vote for Bowman for many reasons, including the fact that if and when he won, I would be able to write a headline called White Hawk Down. And you all make that happen. So without any further ado, and I'm going to open up your article, please tell us about this great piece that you wrote about Engel.
Yeah, I think you captured pretty well White Hawk Down. He had tried to sort of rebrand in the last couple of years. It would be misleading to call him a sort of right-wing Democrat with respect to domestic policy, at least. So, for example, he embraced Medicare for All, which I think is a testament to how effectively that has been advanced within the Congressional Progressive Caucus. When you look at his foreign policy, it's quite a different story. He's pretty well known for being a major recipient, perhaps the top recipient within the House, of pro-Israel PAC funds. And as a matter of fact, during this primary, a Republican group actually funneled money through a Democratic pro-Israel group to Engel, and that was first reported by The Intercept. I thought that was pretty illustrative of his time in Congress, because I started looking through, just his record, and I was astonished by, the number of times he found common cause with not just Republican figures, but even Trump administration folks. So, for example, during the Obama administration, he was pretty widely criticized for opposing the Iran deal until, of course, it passed, at which point when Trump won, then he rebranded and said, well, actually, maybe maybe we want the Iran deal after all, now that a Republican is advancing it. But right. when it was Obama in the White House, he actually gave a joint press conference with Mike Pence, who, of course, at the time was a congressperson. And he joined him to condemn and oppose any UN investigation into the Israeli commando raid of the Gaza flotilla that came to Gaza to try to provide them with humanitarian aid, ended up killing something like 8 or 9 activists. And not only did he oppose it's not like there was an investigation and he disagreed with the results. He didn't want there to be a UN investigation, and his statement for why was pretty much identical to Pence's and the Republicans generally, which is that looking into Israel is of its nature illegitimate, because we have to be they have this term strategic partnership. You are talking about a country that has an ugly human rights record. We call it a strategic partnership, as if there's some kind of realpolitik reason that we have to be adults here and think about think strategically about why we need to condone some of the stuff that a lot of people would think is bad. So that was one example of many. Another one was
Can I ask you something quickly before we go on with that? Is with Israel, though, is it framed as a strategic partnership? Isn't Israel kind of like the bestie of the United States, like the government? We're always, politicians are always calling Israel special friend, special relationship. Do they actually use the term strategic partnership for Israel, or is that reserved for people we're not quite as openly amorous with?
Well, that's an interesting question, because that's changing, and I think this election shows exactly how it's changing. Look at the demographic characteristics of the Democratic Party, younger folks of all ethnic backgrounds are a lot more skeptical of what we do in terms of military aid for Israel than Democratic voters in the past have been. So I think you are going to see a shift away from and towards the rhetoric that we used to describe, our arms exports and coordination with Saudi Arabia, for instance, which itself has become increasingly entwined and working with, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, so on and so forth, working with Israel now, increasingly becoming less and less distinct with respect to their foreign policy. So I think we're going to see a lot of the same language we use to describe, these theocratic, frankly, dictatorships.
Right.
I think the language is going to start to reflect that a lot more.
Mike Pence's suit is incredible.
Oh my God.
In that picture.
Let me see.
That's the Obama suit.
It's like Obama suit. But right. Obama, at least, it fit better. Like, Mike, look at those sleeves. Like, is that color? His older brother's? That's like his older brother's suit. A hand-me-down. It looks terrible.
That's the 3 7-year-olds in the trench coat suit.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
His head is kind of behind. It's like those old dog pictures where they would put the dog's head and try to make it look like he's like playing tennis or something.
Yeah.
Totally.
Dog shit. That out for him?
Yeah. It looks terrible. Well,
it's something about being a Republican. You can't have anything that fits, which is why Elliot Engel's suit doesn't fit either, I think.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Get away. Peter King looks just so Peter Kingian. I mean, God bless him.
He kind of looks like Leland Palmer for any Twin Peaks fans out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does.
He kind of looks like a Yenta, like a Jew, a 60-something-year-old Jewish woman.
Yeah, that too.
Shout out to Chris Shea of The Nation for picking that photo, by the way.
Oh, yeah, thank you, Chris Shea. Yeah.
It illustrates exactly what, that's Engel, is just voting. Not just, so a lot of people know him for, his positions in the Middle East and Israel, but in Latin America, it's bad as well.
Yeah. And the coup in Bolivia?
He was quick to move on to the next government, and they love to frame it as, we need to embrace democracy and have a new election. And it's like, but we just had an election. Like, it's not really a legitimate one if you just decide to ignore the previous one and hold a new one, And so that was sort of his strategy with that. It's very interesting to see people like AOC come in and condemn these things. I've seen people be critical of AOC's foreign policy, and she's certainly more staid than she could be, but she is saying things to the frustration of a lot of the party in the center that causes a lot of headaches for them to have to explain why they're not also, condemning these coups.
Right.
So it is creating an interesting contrast, I think.
And you mentioned in your piece that he wanted to strip Ilhan Omar, right, of her position.
So she had a committee assignment, and this is really why I think this election was so important and why you saw Democratic leadership throwing, a lot of what they had at Bowman to try to stop them, because this wasn't just an ordinary congressional race. There were other primaries taking place that people like Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and all of these top Democrats coming behind Engel in an almost like comical overkill sort of way to try to thumb the scales. They're not just doing that because it's any race. They're doing it because he's chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and I cover a lot of sort of foreign policy, national security type stuff. And something that folks might not know is that Foreign Affairs Committee, they get read into and are given classified briefings all the time that the rest of the public does not get. And that's a huge mechanism of oversight that we have for a lot of this classified information. If you look at the way the laws and our system is constructed, it's really one of the only ways we have for the public to learn about what sorts of classified things are going on. So if they lose a chairmanship like this from someone who is very, gets a lot of money from military contractors and the like, no matter who they replace him with, and they're going to try to replace him with a really bad centrist, I don't dispute that. It's going to be hard to find one who has the same type of politics, quite as reactionary as him. And so when Congress gets these briefings, they can come to a reporter like me, they can leak these classified things to us, and it's actually legal. It's basically legal for them to do so. That's really important. When to give you an example, we have you mentioned Ilhan Omar. So if you get the right people on these committees, you end up getting people that were involved in war crimes grilled, as you saw her do.
That was amazing,
with Elliot Abrams, which is really a historic moment. I can't think of a time when someone that powerful had to face not just questions about were you competent in how you carried out X horrible military policy, but it was fundamentally wrong and immoral. I don't know that I've ever seen anything like that before. It was really startling. Mm-hmm. So they try really hard to lock down these committee assignments because they don't want it to go, because you see what happens when you've got people with relatively progressive politics that have these seats.
Ken, I have a question. How, you know, you're a very good investigative reporter. How do you get these national security ghouls to talk to you?
Good question.
What's interesting is they actually appreciate that I have, you know, unconventional politics. I think they get sick of the kind of center lib kind of thing. And there's a lot, there's a whole lot more going on than whatever the, you know, Mueller investigation or the Ukraine investigation now. They have concerns above and beyond a lot of that. And it, in my experience, a lot of them, they've talked to folks from the Times and they're not interested in what they have to say. So I have a very different, you know, when I was younger and coming into this, I thought, how am I going to do this? Because I don't really believe a lot of what, and it, to my surprise, it's been sort of a, not at all what I expected. There's actually a lot of people that need someone to go, because these guys, if you have a security clearance, you can't be, they actually get polygraphed about who they talk to. So they can't be public facing at all. They need a dissent channel in the media to air out their concerns. And if it's all just this kind of, you know, New York Times, Maggie Haberman kind of stuff, there's serious limits on what they're going to be able to get through, you know? So to me, I'm more like, I have more stuff than I have time to go through. And I didn't expect it to be this way at all. And, you know, I'll say, you know, a lot of my, I think people would be surprised how many of my sources are conservative. I'm not saying, you know, all of them are, or I'm not commenting generally because I don't want to get anyone in trouble, but I think folks would be surprised how many people just don't feel represented by the sort of liberal consensus that exists in the mainstream media. And they're happy to talk to someone just outside of that, whether that's the left or whatever it is, you know.
Come here, you crazy commie. I got to tell you something.
Yeah.
But you're that's the kind of how they talk here. To me.
Yeah.
Also, like, if you can own the libs for them. Yeah.
That's
yeah,
true. Yeah. True, right. Because they have their own. I mean, there is such a dearth because there are far right people that they can talk to.
But they don't have any very little,
they're very little to the left of the sort of consensus. You know what I mean? Like, they're right. It's really limited.
Yeah, which of course people will try to attack. Like, people use what you just said as a way to try to delegitimize you, as opposed to realizing the truth, which is that, like, the liberal media is so bad that the there worst. Are so few places. And again, that doesn't mean you embrace Trump. And look, this is so obvious. I don't know why we have to keep explaining this or debating this, but, like, there have always been overlaps, political overlaps, with people who, with whom we disagree. That's nothing new. But have you experienced this more because with Trump as president? Like, has that been that kind of trend you're talking about been?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because well, and how 100%. Much of that is?
Well, that's the other thing is that this is this job, not to wax poetic, but it's like almost been a kind of spiritual thing for me to see that there are people who profess to have certain views. And a lot of that is pretty superficial. And in fact, they'll stick their neck out and take risks. And do stuff that and end up doing things that might be more in accord with what I would consider, you know, sort of anti-authority, maybe socialist, however you want to call it.
Yeah.
And maybe they describe themselves as conservative, but that's sort of a cultural affiliation rather than really what I would call, you know, like how they live their lives. So I actually have a lot of people that, like, on paper, I would think, oh, this guy's ridiculous. Or, you know, maybe they even say some dumb stuff. But, you know, I have people that have, you know, told and give me stuff they could get in serious trouble for. And to me, that, you know, that speaks to kind of integrity that I don't think is sort of captured by. And I think that you see a lot of possibility because there's a whole lot of people that are left out of this sort of boring consensus that I was describing before. I think that stuff is a lot less popular than people realize. And even if someone calls themselves, you know, conservative or liberal, I don't know. A lot of times that I find that to be pretty skin deep.
Hmm. Mm. Yeah. It's just like what team they're on, really, not so much like their.
Yeah. Even aside from leaking or whistleblowing, I'll even talk to them sometimes about, like, healthcare stuff, and they'll actually be, like, pretty open to things. It's kind of like they just hadn't heard a lot of it, you know? And these are, I see, like, intelligence community people are generally, a lot of them have pretty decent degrees. You would think that they'd be pretty, indoctrinated, frankly, and there's a lot more openness. I think just because the system is falling apart, there's no legitimacy. They see day to day how absurd everything is, and in a way that is scary because, you know, we don't know what's going to replace the systems that are collapsing. But at least for someone like me as a reporter, and I would imagine politically more generally, that's a big opportunity for people that have something else to say. And that's certainly, you know, I found that to be sort of fruitful in terms of people's willingness to work with me.
And how did you get into journalism? I mean, there's so I feel a little guilty because there's so much politics to be talking about. But I am curious about your story personally.
Oh, gosh. It was really Occupy Wall Street because I graduated right like in the middle of the crash in after college, you know. And I never expected to be rich or anything. I had kind of hoped I would have like an okay job, you know, and I was unemployed for like, I don't know, like two or three. I mean, I worked at a restaurant for a couple years and like, and once the economy kind of recovered, I really forgot about how awful all that was.
We lost him right when he was getting to the good part.
Oh, here you are. Okay, great.
He's back.
Oh, we sorry. Lost you. Sorry about that. Yeah. So,
you want to capture the darkness and despair. So when it's all black screen, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The light comes through, the light starts shining through. Then it's like the before after pictures on Instagram. It's like, here's the new me. Yeah. But so after several years of that, it was really, I mean, I was always, you know, I think I always had kind of unorthodox political views, but, it made it real to experience unemployment. And it's not just about like necessarily bills. It's like, you're not really included in the society. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, yeah. You're not really given a place. How to describe it? Like, in feudalism, as bad as it was, everyone had a sort of place.
Role. There were no unemployed people in feudalism.
Right. Everyone had that life. Everyone was taken care of.
Yeah. Right. And it's like, beyond just the food you get from that, it's like you have a identity. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's really hard to have an identity when you're unemployed, or at least it was for me. Yeah. So then, I don't know. I never forgot that. And it made me kind of like really not be able to buy into the system, you know,
so to speak. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Where were you? Where were you living at this point?
Madison, Wisconsin. I lived there for like, I don't know, like nine years. I only just moved out to DC for this job. Like five or six months ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really, yeah. And is your family progressive? I mean, I don't even know how you describe yourself politically, but do you come from a family with views similar to yours?
I think it was similar to what I was talking about with the intelligence community, where it's like they would probably describe themselves.
Leon Panetta is your father.
Right. So my mom was she's from El Salvador. She's what's called an immigrant, but I mean, she had to leave during the war. I mentioned Elliot Abrams before. I was like very, it had a lot of personal significance for me to see someone, you know, herself from a, you know, very impoverished country stand up to somebody like that who is doing the impoverishing, you know, and that's why my mom immigrated. And so I think because, I mean, you know, that's extraordinary poverty. And without getting into the personal stuff too much, like, I think that likewise made it very hard for her to believe in any of this kind of, I mean, this Millennium Corporation kind of like, you know, earned income tax credit stuff. That's just ridiculous when you know anyone that's had to deal with it. You know what I mean? Like, so I don't know that she's like, you know, going to start talking about the Communist Manifesto or anything. Like, she's not, you know, literate in that sense. But I think she always had a kind of streetwise attitude about how power works. And that has made her and my dad. That's a whole nother story. My dad is Mennonite. Do you guys know what Mennonites are?
Yeah.
Vaguely.
They're like very anti-war.
So yeah. Okay, right.
But where are they originally? Where are they from originally? They're like.
Kind of like Ukraine, Eastern Europe. Yeah. Yeah. Disinformazia. Maybe that's why he's outside of the liberal consensus. But he never really fit in. That's what I find. The people that don't really fit, they always kind of seem to have a good perspective on things. You know what I mean? Like, because it's like, I couldn't really be, I don't know that it could be established if I wanted to, because it's just, I don't really know how to, it's so boring. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't go to those parties and things if I had to. But
misfit politique.
I don't know. I just kind of stumbled into it. It wasn't really a plan. So, you know, a lot of people know me for FOIA. I just found that on just reading the news. I was like, wow, that's really cool. I just started doing it for fun. And then next thing I realized, it was like,
people probably know,
Freedom of Information Act, open records requests. And like I was saying before, the sources, like, I don't know how much of a charmed life I lead so much as that there's not a whole lot of competition. Like, who at the major outlets is really.
How many investigative reporters are there?
Not very many. I mean, I came in as
nine.
Yeah. When I first came into this, there's not, and among the ones that do FOIA, there's like Jason Leopold, maybe, you know, there's like a couple, and certainly not that many on the national level. So to me, it was like there just really wasn't very much competition to be had. And when I had something, people would be like, wait, this isn't a take? Yeah, I want to see it. You know what I mean? Like, and I was amazed because it's like, they kind of, what I was saying before about the politics, people, a lot of editors will kind of overlook the political stuff they don't like, because it's kind of like, wait, you have a primary source document? I want that. You know what I mean? So.
Right. Yeah. Primary source. That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
That it's really crazy. I mean, you know, reporting has, you know, it's probably at its like lowest point ever in terms of volume and maybe standards. Like there's just fewer reporters, you know, that than there were 10, 15 years ago. How do you see the profession these days, or do you see a future for it, or do you see like young people getting into it? I don't know. Like, I'm sure you get asked all the time, like, how do I do what you do? And it's like, well,
I feel terrible. I never know what to say because these kids, like, I was also told, don't do it. It's impossible. You'll never make it. And so I don't want to say that, but at the same time, it's this poor kid. It's like, it is, there's not very many jobs, you know? So I don't really know what to tell them. I don't want to.
Yeah.
Mislead some kid and then have him regret it like a few years later, you know. So I guess I really think that what has to change in terms of investigative reporting, I mean, there are a lot of things, but the biggest problems are institutional. Like, obviously, you know, we all, like, Chris Lizza drives everyone nuts, all those guys, but there's a reason. It's not a mistake when you get literally the dumbest people consistently coming to the top. That to me, that says that there's something about how the system is designed. You know what I mean? Like, they kind of, dumb people will do what they're told, and they're not gonna, you know, like Thomas Friedman, all that. I don't think it's a mistake, but anyways.
So I think one. I was in a cab in
Kuala Lumpur,
Mozambique.
Yeah,
on my way to meet with an app developer. Did you guys see this? Bill Gates has this thing where it's gonna. He was going around. This is literally true. He's drinking like water generated from like fecal matter, and he's saying this is gonna like save Africa. So instead of just letting Africa develop, we're going to make an app to let them drink fecal water. Yes. I'm not even kidding. This is
liberal,
real. I
couldn't. Liberal bullshit. Yeah.
Bullshit. Literally. Wait.
I remember for a while there was this technology that was a soccer ball that if you kicked it around, it would generate like electricity, and you could light like a hut in Africa.
Why would you like that, Nando?
What?
You're a soccer man.
I am a soccer man, but that's ridiculous. Oh, you know, like, this is ridiculous.
Right now? You're against sports ball now?
Yeah, I'm against it. Yeah. I'm against sports ball.
Okay, no, but to answer a question, this is a really important question. How to fix media. Just in one sentence, my pitch. I don't really think it's extraordinary. Like, there's a lot of features, but I don't think the main thing is extraordinarily complicated, which is that Facebook and Google have monopolies that are stealing most of the revenue, and they don't have money anymore. End of story. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of other things. Unionization is important. They're critical. You know, alternative media, that's really important, because you guys can actually, you guys have more power than you think in terms of pressuring the major media to follow things. I really think that's true. Because I came into this thinking, oh, I'm going to be bitter because I'm always on the outside. I was never allowed in. Actually, like, I've seen major media. So you mentioned my Antifa story. They all followed that stuff because shockingly, they don't break a whole lot outside of what's given to them from the press secretaries.
Right. Yeah.
I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush because there's good people at, always good people.
There's good people at the New York Times. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, generally, this kind of, you guys would be surprised how many stories that are leaks are just coming from White House people.
The thing that I think is under discussed on the left with regards to the media, and it used to be a thing that was just a totem in the 1960s and 70s, which was the idea of a public media. You know, I think that there's this idea here that a public media is inevitably going to be corrupted by whomever's in power. And that's a danger, obviously, but there's a way to structure, there's ways to structure it. And I'm sure smart people who think about this shit can figure it out. But, you know, the idea of a public media, like, information is a public good. We all deserve it. We need it to function, just like we need electricity and water. And we need a public media that is publicly funded, that advocates for our interests because it's publicly funded, instead of funded by advertisers or Facebook and Google, like you said. But like, no one talks about it, or no one even thinks about it. And I can't see any other way to create institutions that are big and broad and national, that are well funded and but also independent of commercial pressures.
Yeah.
I think at some point there's going to just have to be a breakup of these monopolistic structures, because Google AdSense is insane in terms of how many clicks you need to get a saleable revenue. What's crazy, it's getting to the point now that these sort of, I've always worked for pretty progressive outlets, and I'm actually making more than some of these like well-educated kids that go into the big corporate places that you would think would have infinite money. And, you know, many of them do have a lot of resources, but you would be surprised how tight of margins they're running, because, you know, when Facebook and Google take their cut, what's left is a system where you can have, you know, 100,000 clicks and that generates maybe a couple hundred bucks. And that's
it's crazy.
The amount of power they have is absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, like, completely aside from the...
When I was at Fusion, I did a video for Facebook that got like, I want to say like 50 million views or something preposterous like that. And I was like, oh shit. And then I asked like the boss was like, did that like make any money for like what, for the company? Or like we made $600. And I was like, just the cost to make this was not even close. And this is like our most watched video ever. And I'm like, how is this going to work?
Right. You're going to tell me, you're going to tell me 10 million, like, you know, America, relatively affluent country, 10 million views isn't worth like at least like, you know, $1,000 or something.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Like, I don't, you know, I'm not an economist, but it's like that money is going because those eyeballs are valuable because they, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But nobody seems to, everyone just takes as a feature of the universe, a physical matter that Google can just take what it wants, you know?
Yeah. And also people always assume that like, you know, public media or state media, et cetera, they're inherently corrupt or oppressive, but corporate media somehow has no
ulterior. It's independent and free. Yeah. And it's like, no.
Yeah. Nando, I know you have to get off because you had told me your schedule earlier.
And, I have a very busy schedule.
Ken, I would love to keep chatting if you have more time.
No, that's fine. It was nice meeting you, Nando. I followed you for a while, so it's cool to chat. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see you another one. Bye,
Take
Nando. Thanks for coming on. See you next week. Bye. So yeah, any questions? There's some questions that I just want to give people the chance to listen. There's one. Thoughts on how the Never Trumpers, Lincoln Project crew, et cetera, will fold into a Biden administration, merge into an even worse Republican Party, et cetera?
I mean, they will try to do that, but I hope that what this, you know, primary showed us is that there is still pressure.
Please join our Patreon, which is patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow to hear the rest of my interview with Ken Klippenstein. And it gets even more interesting. And we talk about neo-Nazis and why that's not a bigger story right now. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.